So the first speaker will be none other than the president-elect for next year, Lanya Ross. She works at the Metropolitan Council and has done so since 2006 as an environmental scientist working in their water resource planning functions that they do over there. She also worked for several years in the early 2000s for the Shakopee Mittewatin Sioux community as a hydrogeologist. And the title of her talk is Estimating Infiltration and Recharge in the Twin Cities Metropolitan Area. Please welcome Lanya Ross, your president next year.
Thank you. That was a very, very good introduction. I'm a little intimidated by the living up to that, but I will do my best. So today I get to talk about one of the recent projects that we've been working on at the Metropolitan Council, and I'm very, very excited about it. I find it very interesting, and I hope that you all do too. And so I'm also a little intimidated, but also excited to be the first speaker here, so I hope it's a good kickoff to the rest of the day. I'm going to be focusing today on really sort of a high-level look at infiltration, and then one of the tools that we've been using to estimate how it varies across the landscape and through time in the metropolitan area. So I tried to make sure that many of the slides as possible were sort of colorful and wouldn't put you to sleep, but poke somebody if they start to snore. So to keep me on track, because I do tend to go off on tangents, I do kind of want to set myself up with a roadmap, and it really just comes down to I'd like you to leave this presentation, not that anybody really needs the pressure, but to understand the importance of the need for infiltration and recharge information, to have a sense of the soil-water balance model that we are using, and then some of the details of how we have applied this in the Twin Cities metro area. So just to give you a sense of what does the input data look like, what are the results that we're getting out of this, and then some understanding of the sensitivity of the model results to some of the parameter uncertainty, so you kind of have a sense of how to interpret the results. So I'd like to cover all of that, and we'll see how far I get before I start to get waved off stage. So I think really basically, we need information about infiltration because it's the ultimate source of groundwater. And I had to put this presentation up there because this is my son's favorite slide, and he thinks it looks like a very comfortable green chair. And I think that's a nice vision for sort of the water cycle in the world. You know, it provides our comfort, it provides our quality of life, it's our water. So I kind of go with that comforting view of our water cycle. But I do want to point out one important thing as I talk. I'm talking about a process we're using to estimate infiltration, and I do not mean the same thing as recharge. We're considering those two different ways when we're thinking about the soil-water balance model that we're using in the metropolitan area. Infiltration is, of course, the water that's coming down through the soil, and as it goes through the root zone, of course, a lot of it is transpired. There's a lot of evaporation that takes place, and so a lot of that infiltration is not recharging our underlying deeper aquifers. Even below the root zone, some of that infiltrating water is moving horizontally. It's ending up as sort of perched aquifers, not going into the deeper regional system. But it's that movement below the root zone that I'm focusing on today. And that is sort of that what's available to then become recharge deeper in our aquifer system. So I just want to make that very clear as I go through this presentation. Why this is so important to us, and for the metropolitan area in particular, I think some of you have probably seen this information before, but I think it's important to remember that over half of Minnesota's population lives in the 7-county metropolitan area. And so when we think about water supplies, that is an important impact on the entire state. And most of the water that's used here is from groundwater. So 70% of the water used here generally is from the groundwater, 30% from surface water, the Mississippi River, and of course base flow is a big contribution to that source as well. So groundwater, infiltration, recharge, pretty critical. And it's a changing system that over time in the metropolitan area, the percentage of groundwater versus the percentage of surface water used has been changing. So in the 40s, which is on the left, you can see that most of the water that we were using came from the Mississippi River. But over time, that has shifted. So now it's very dominated by the groundwater source. And that changed really in about the 70s. We had that growth of the outer ring suburbs, the highway system, that expansion out from those two core cities. And that made a really fundamental change on the water supply system for the metropolitan area, driving us towards more and more use of groundwater. So impacts on infiltration and recharge, of course, having a bigger impact on more people across the region. And that is where the Metropolitan Council got involved. And so that's why I am standing here talking about this topic. As we have this growing metropolitan area, this shift in our water supply sources, we've had some growing issues. And in 2005, the Minnesota State Legislature mandated that the Metropolitan Council shall engage in water supply planning activities, and that included the creation of a master water supply plan for our metropolitan area. So that's what got us really actively engaged in water supply planning. Before then, we've always had a role. We've always supported research projects, supported planning for water supply, but this was a really explicitly defined role for us for the first time. So I am here. We are doing projects like infiltrating or estimating infiltration. Our really main goal here is, and this was done with a lot of outreach. I know many of you were involved in that. We did a lot of outreach with communities. The goal of that master water supply plan is to ensure a sustainable water supply for future and current generations. No small task. And the scope of it, I think, is well illustrated. This is one of my favorite maps. This is a map of the wells in the metropolitan area, the active wells in the metropolitan area. So the orange I just threw up there so you could see the public community wells. So municipal, but then other public wells. And you can see that in the core cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul, we don't have those public supplies. They're mostly supplied by those cities. But we do see those public wells kind of out in the developed areas, urban areas in the metropolitan area. The blue wells are the private wells, and I've shaded them so that the darker blue are the older wells drilled in the 40s, and the lighter wells are those drilled in the last decade. And you can see that they sort of radiate out. You can see them growing out from that core cities as we've been growing in those suburbs. So this is now a metropolitan area with over 60,000 active wells blanketing the whole region. And so when we talk about planning for water supply, that is a lot of information to put together. Oh, come on. What you're missing is a really nice cross-section through the middle of the Twin Cities. Just envision it. You all, this is Groundwater Association, so I know that you can envision this. The tool we're using to put all of that information together for the metropolitan area and to evaluate the cumulative and also the long-term impacts of all those individual well and water use decisions is a regional groundwater flow model. Metropolitan Council developed a groundwater flow model. We call it the Metro Model 2 because we kind of built off of the PCA's earlier Metro model to support the Master Water Supply Plan. So we completed that in 2009. It's 9 layers, and that's what you're missing here, is the geometry of sort of this 9-layer model in the metropolitan area. But the important part of what I wanted to say here did show up, and that is that the big input into this model is the recharge, and the big output is base flow to the major rivers and also pumping. And so that recharge, understanding that recharge, is a really critical part of our modeling and our evaluation of the metro area water supplies. Oh. So anyway, so you get a sense of the complexity and the variability in this model geometry. That's good. Just wanted to give you a sense of what the model looks like. Again, east to west through the center of the metropolitan area. And so this is just gives you a sense of, as we update this model, a lot of this geometry has remained the same. We've tweaked it because we've, since 2009, had some geologic atlas work done. There's been some great work by the Minnesota Geological Survey to characterize properties in the Quaternary sediments. And so that information is what we are now working on putting into an update of the regional model. We're also expanding that model. So you can kind of see, if I can get this to work, the Metro Model 2 boundary here is this blue line, which really focused on the 7-county metropolitan area. We've expanded that, and in particular expanded it up here in the north and west metro because of the wanting to be able to account for some of the planned growth along the I-94 corridor and in some of those communities. So just to give you a sense of some of the changes in that regional model, and I know that Evan is here today from Barr Engineering, Evan Christensen, who's been doing the bulk of the work on this modeling effort, and we're going to be wrapping that up, and there's an article in the MGWA March newsletter if you want to know a little bit more about that process. Because we expanded this model domain so much for our regional groundwater flow model, we also needed to reapproach and expand the area we covered for our infiltration estimates. The infiltration kind of being that first input, that upper limit on the recharge that goes into that regional groundwater flow model. So that's what I'm really going to talk about today. The reason that we did this was, one, to better evaluate how that infiltration, and again, water going below the root zone, is varying in time and across the 11-county metropolitan area, not just the 7-county metropolitan area. This is a critical input for the Metro Model 3, our updated regional groundwater flow model. And we also, as we went through this process, wanted to be compatible and to think about the fact that there's a project going on right now with PCA and USGS to use the SWB model to look at infiltration and recharge across the entire state. So we wanted to be compatible and just be thinking about that effort as well as we went through this project. What we are working on and what we used for Metro Model 2, and then also what we are updating now for Metro Model 3, is the soil water balance model that was developed by the U.S. Geological Survey. And we're using this because that is a great tool that was developed by the USGS exactly for this type of modeling effort. We used it in Metro Model 2, and it was a really useful tool for us, and so we saw really good value in using it again for this updated model. You're a very geeky crowd, and I don't feel like going into too many details here, so I'm giving you some references that I think are very useful. This will be posted on the website, so if you want to go and check out some of these resources, I really encourage you to do so. Some very good information. The first is that USGS report, which I think is a great reference. And then the second two are some resources just to give you a sense of some of the information that we're thinking about as we began to link the SWB model, that infiltration model, to the regional groundwater flow model. Because, again, infiltration not being the same as recharge, how do you link those two appropriately? So if you're interested in more details, there's a lot of good information out there to explore. If you are more of a face-to-face kind of information gatherer, I wanted to introduce you and call out our project team. So Metropolitan Council was the lead. We're funding this project for our regional planning work. I was the project manager for this. We have a new staff member in the audience, Annika LaBelle, here. I can't believe her. Anyway, if you haven't met her, come and meet her. So she's been doing some work with this right now, too, as she's taking on more of the modeling role with the Met Council. Bar Engineering did the work for us, and so Tim Brown, who is not with Bar anymore, was the manager for this at Bar. Evan Christensen, who is here, has been working too with the SWB model and also bringing it into the Metro Model 3. So if you have questions, feel free to ask us, stop us, and catch us. This was supported by the Clean Water Fund, and so I think it's important to always acknowledge the projects that are being funded by that source and just appreciate that that is still out there and generating a lot of good new information. Sorry, I have duplicate slides. I think this one is a better description of what I'm really trying to say. But just to walk you through now, so the approach that we took, so I hopefully kind of got at why we're doing this and what we're using it for. What we actually did was to apply this SWB model, which includes compiling climate data, landscape characteristics, land use, hydrologic soil type, flow direction, the available water capacity, basic information about land cover and soil type, and then some information about those soils and land uses. So we have a lookup table and soil retention table. This is pretty basic, and that's one of the great things about this approach. We are using readily available data. It's a GIS-based sort of data set, so you can get a lot of this data, work with it, analyze it in your mapping software. We can really kind of look at how these characteristics are varying over space and time. So that was a very useful tool as you're working with this model. And it's very simple to run. These are big data sets. It takes a long time to run some of these, depending on the scale. But really, I think a very nice, straightforward approach. So to kind of give you a sense of what does this input look like for the model we built in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, I'm just going to walk you through some of I just think it's really helpful to kind of look at the variation and how it varied across the metropolitan areas. The climate input, and this is a difference. The first time when we did the SWB for the Metro Model 2, we used climate data from the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, and we just assumed it was consistent across our entire seven-county metropolitan area. This time, we used 191 stations with data from 1980 to 2011. You can see their distribution. We wanted to kind of collect data from outside the metro to make sure as we interpolated it, we wouldn't get the edge effects. We were interpolating daily precipitation, daily minimum temperatures, and daily maximum temperatures. And that's because this model uses that daily data to calculate the flow in the through the system. But we don't use that daily data in terms of... are combining it up to monthly data. So you kind of hear this is a daily soil water balance model. That's for the calculation purposes. For what we're using actually monthly time steps because when our modeling, we're going to do some transient work. We wanted to compare that to the monthly pumping data that's available in SWDs, and so that's kind of the unit that we're looking at this data in. Just okay, that's down into the weeds. This is what I tend to do, and this is why I tend to go over. But keep that in mind. We're going to be showing some results at the monthly for the use in our modeling, and then also annually, because then you can see that annual variation in infiltration over time, and I think that's very useful to consider as well. We actually had an interesting discussion as we did this climate data with our technical advisory group, and that was in doing the interpolation, comparing that against some of the radar data from different storm events to just kind of do as a check on how our interpolation was working, and that brought up the possibility that you could be using some of that radar data as an input data set for the SWB. We didn't do that in this case because we didn't have that data available for the entire record we were looking at, but I think that's an interesting approach, and that's possible using this model. So if you do have a project where that's an option, I think that's worth considering. Land use is, of course, a very important input to the model, and so here's what one of our land use distribution or one of our land use maps looks like. Where we, outside of the seven-county metropolitan area, we relied on the USGS 2006 land cover data, but within the seven-county metropolitan area, obviously the Metropolitan Council, with its tie to land use planning, has a lot of land use maps, and so we took advantage of those in the seven-county metropolitan area. In some of our parks or other areas where the land cover wasn't well described by that data set, we did use that USGS just to get a better sense of if it was, you know, grassland or forest, for example. But for the most part, in the seven-county metro, we relied on that Metropolitan Council land use. And so we have several different data sets to draw on, so we actually do include changing land use in the model that we built. We don't have it changing daily, so we did have to sort of assign certain land use years to different periods of record. And so just to give you a sense of it, we applied the 1990 Metropolitan Council mapped land use to the years 1988 to 1993. And so there is that sort of block changes of land use. But I think representing that growing urban land cover was important. Soils are also very important when we're thinking about infiltration capacity. And so this is the USDA NRCS Soil Survey geographic database was the source for this. And so you can see the Anoka Sand Plain standing out in that buff color in the north. And so this is a map of the soil hydrologic classes, A, B, C, and D. And so that's the primary input to this model. And you can kind of get a sense that there is quite a bit of variation across the 11-county metropolitan area. Well, this actually shows up pretty well on the big screens. But this is the data, an example of the lookup table of assigning different data to those data sets. So for every land use category, we have open water, low-density residential, high-density residential is a land cover. There's areas we've assigned as bare rock or soil, open water, wetlands, row crops. So a variety of these land cover classifications. And for each of those land covers, we assigned a curve number for each of the different soil hydrologic groups, maximum recharge, root zone depth. So this gives you a sense of the data that the model is working with as it goes through the model code. Available water capacity is also an important part of this process. I'm getting behind here. But wanting to know, you know, different soils are basically going to be able to take on a different amount of water. So given how wet your soil is when another round of precipitation falls, you're going to be able to infiltrate a different amount of water. And so we wanted to make sure that we're incorporating that information into the model as well. And finally, flow direction. We did use the USGS digital elevation models. We also included the streamlines. And this is something that is different between the model that we used in the metropolitan area, and I understand the USGS model statewide, they're using 1 kilometer grids, and so having those explicit streamlines as part of that model just doesn't make sense at that scale. But here in the metropolitan area, we are using 90 meter cells, and so we actually included those streamlines and sort of burned them into the DEM so that as the SWB model was going through the flow routing, so precipitation falls on a cell depending on how wet the soil is, how much it's able to absorb, the root zone depth, et cetera. Some of that will infiltrate. Whatever's excess will then run off to the downslope cell, and the same thing will happen. Eventually, with the streamlines burned in, it will go down into a stream, and then if it doesn't infiltrate, it's assumed that it will leave the model. So it's kind of how that process works. So the results. Putting this all together, running the model, which took days, because when you're covering the 11-county metropolitan area in a 90 by 90-meter grid spacing, it takes a while to process. But I tried to make the results look as colorful as possible because I think it's exciting and awesome, and I wanted to convey that. But you do really clearly see the Anoka sand plain standing out. Not a lot of surprise that when you have those really sandy soils, you know, that is going to be a strong control on how much water is able to get into the system. This is simply the relative, this is just a relative scale of infiltration, so red being sort of higher than the metropolitan area or the model average infiltration rates, blue being lower. You can see that there's we assume no infiltration going in to those surface water bodies, for example, that those are, there's surface water there for a reason. Now we know that there is some through flow in some of these surface water bodies, so that is some of the uncertainty in this model. But standing water means your infiltration rates are relatively low. So you can see also one thing I'd like to point out to me, particularly when I go into meetings with people, a lot of people fixate on the fact that the core downtown cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul are showing up as perhaps a little higher infiltration rate than some people think makes sense. And that gets at one of the really important parts of this model, and that is that first, in those downtown areas, we have a lot of very sandy soils, but they are not 100% paved. In between those parking lots, in between those streets, we have a lot of lawns, we have a lot of boulevards, we have some gravel parking lots in some of the industrial areas, and where you have that very low, short root zone above those sandy soils, you're able to get water past that quite easily. And so in some of these more urban or suburban areas where we have where we've converted prairie grass or row crops with high evaporation ET rates to turf grass, you actually can get, see on the very, very left, you can see the root zone depth of turf grass versus all of the prairie natives. And that this diagram to me is just a good reminder of, because this model is calculating infiltration below the root zone depth, it takes a lot less to get below the root zone of turf grass than it does to get below the root zone of any of these native prairie plants or below the root zone of a tree canopy or if you have a forested area. So that's important to keep in mind with these model results. So that was kind of big picture results. Oh, sorry, forgot. I had some numbers for you. Across the model domain, the average infiltration for the period 1988 to 2011 was about 8 inches per year. But that varies quite a bit depending on the year and even depending on the month. And so the maximum infiltration year was 2002 for 13 inches per year. The minimum, 2000 at 2.7 inches per year. So that's quite a bit of variation. And so recharge can actually be quite low depending on the weather patterns of a particular year. So I'm going to take a couple of slides to kind of walk through how that varies from year to year. I had to throw up 1993 because it is not the wettest, most infiltration year on record. But to me, this will always be the wettest year I've ever known. This is the year I graduated from high school, and every single graduation event that I went to was flooded out. I was stuck in like the locker room in my high school basement for almost an entire night because we were flooded. The 500-year flood surrounded my house, literally flooded my car. 18-year-old without a car. I will never forget this. But it was not the year that we got the most infiltration, and that is because the timing of precipitation events is also very important, and I think this model highlights that. If you have a lot of rain falling in June, in July, where you have very high evaporation, a lot of ET going on, that is not going to infiltrate. Whereas if you have more larger precipitation occurring earlier in the season, in March, in April, that big snowpack melting, that's where you're going to get more, like a larger part of your water getting down into the system. And that's also an important thing to keep in mind when we're looking at this model and kind of thinking about how infiltration is occurring across the metro, well, or anywhere. I also think this is important to kind of show how infiltration really varies, and we see this in other months and other years. Depending on, there may have been a really large storm event in one localized part of the region. And so you may see a big effect kind of localized. So this is kind of an interesting to see those patterns and how that can shift across the region as well. This is 2000, so this was that driest year on record. And so you can see a very stark difference. Some very, very dry areas of the metropolitan area. And 2002 being the wettest. And you can see a lot of infiltration occurring, but there are even parts, you know, the southwest part of the metropolitan area, the study area, not getting as much infiltration. And so so this is kind of, it's very interesting and I think very valuable to kind of understand the variation across space, but also through time as we're interpreting these model results. This is 2006, the year that I was hired at the Metropolitan Council, and kind of the depths of when all this master water supply planning was going on. And it was not a particularly wet year, and it was not a very a year that we were getting a lot of infiltration either. And so I think this was kind of something that everybody else was aware of this too. I mean, we kind of went through some dry years, and I do think that that informed a lot of the thinking that went into the master water supply plan and sort of has been driving people's understanding of the importance of some of these issues. So kind of wanted to check out that year what it was like for infiltration. And then finally, when the master water supply plan was approved, you can see things are a little bit different. And this also kind of coincided with sort of the slowdown. This was 2006, 2010, slowdown in the economic growth. So a lot of the pressure came off, not because of infiltration rates. But in terms of working on water supply issues, I think sort of the combination of a wetter year kind of takes the pressure off the thinking about water supply. Slowdown in growth takes the pressure off the thinking about supply. And so there's these interesting environmental and social factors that kind of all relate to sort of land use and water supply planning that to me kind of come together in this type of modeling. So that was kind of the inputs and the results we got from our model. I do want to spend a little bit of time talking about how did these results compare to some of the other recharge efforts that have been made out there, because I think one thing maybe some of you have noticed is that I didn't put up any calibration data in any of those slides. And that is because we really don't have regional set of calibration data for infiltration. I mean, we have short-term site-specific studies. You know, will this site be good for a rain garden? We'll do a quick assessment and find out. That's the type of data, and there's no, it's not compiled anywhere. It's, oh, I happen to know about it. I've worked in this watershed. So that's something that's been missing from this effort, and I think we'll hear more about that in some of these other presentations, but I want to point that out. But we do have other efforts to look at the issue of recharge and infiltration, so we were able to compare what we were doing against work that others have done using different approaches. So first of all, how did what we do with this these new approach to using the SWB model compared to what we did before? In 2008, we used the SWB model as an input to the Metro Model 2. We used one climate station at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. This time, we used varying climate data across the model domain. In 2008, we assumed a constant land use. This time, we used changing land use. So what did? How do those two models compare? The green line on the lower side is the results from the SWB model, which we did from 1997 through 2003. And the red line is the updated SWB model that we did. So you can see the overlap. Up on the top is the precipitation at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, just to give you a sense of sort of how those compare order of magnitude. And so you do see that there are some differences, and I think that what you're seeing there is that difference in the precipitation event primarily and how we're handling that, but just to kind of give you a sense of how those are comparing and how can we translate this information that we did before to what we're doing now. We also did have the ability to, some work done in Little Rock Creek, some SWOT modeling, was in our model domain, and so we were able to compare the results done through that effort to the SWB. And so the SWB model is in the purple line, and the SWOT recharge estimate is in the red line. And you see that there is sort of a difference in timing in particular that I kind of want to point out. And so that is something to consider, too, that the SWB model is calculating infiltration below the root zone, but it is not calculating the time it takes to go from the root zone down to the underlying aquifers. And so there's a lag there, and that was one of the challenges of linking the SWB model to the Metro Model 3. And that's beyond this presentation now, but I want to bring that up and just kind of acknowledge that that's one of the challenges we're dealing with. This is a comparison between the SWB infiltration rates on the vertical axis against the USGS regional regression recharge method done in 2007, I believe, on the horizontal axis. And so you can see that these numbers are kind of above that line, but that is to be expected. We're calculating infiltration, which is expected to be more than recharge. So I want to keep that in mind, but to give you a sense of how they compare. And again, just to reiterate, too, if I have to leave you with something, is that this SWB model is an infiltration model. It's a good input to those regional recharge models, but you do have to consider the fact that it is not an exact match for recharge. And so how you link those two is something to be you have to think about as you're going through your modeling process. The uncertainty of all of these, each of these input data sets has some uncertainty to it, and you can kind of see as we're comparing it to different approaches that kind of raises some questions as well about why are these different, how do they compare. So we did do a sensitivity analysis comparing we varied the most sensitive parameters for different land use and soil combinations. For example, we allowed the maximum amount of recharge for each soil type and combination to vary. So we allowed the model to put in more recharge up to a certain limit and then ratcheted that down and said, no, only this much recharge is allowed. So kind of allowed that to vary. We allowed the root zone depth under different soil types and land covers to vary. And we also did allow the curve numbers assigned to those land use types to vary somewhat to see what effect did that have on model results. And so this is one way of looking at that, just to give you a sense of across the model domain what the variation was as we tweaked those sensitive parameters. And so you can see that where we see the most variation, where we have sort of that most uncertainty about that estimate, is really along those transportation corridors, some of that commercial industrial area, which makes sense. I mean, these are the areas where we're going in, we're modifying the soils, we're rerouting stormwater, and so what effect is that having on infiltration rates? That's kind of really highlighting that issue to me. I think I've talked quite a bit about the challenges and some of the limitations with this. First, think about the uncertainty. Think about, what does this regional approach and the uncertainty associated with those input data sets mean, and how do we want to use it? This model was designed to inform that regional scale modeling and planning effort. This is not designed for informing a decision about whether or not you should put a rain garden on a particular site. So that's important to keep in mind. Again, I kind of stress this. Although this is a daily soil water balance model, we're not using daily data. We're not using this to estimate what's the daily infiltration in the metropolitan area. This is for looking at broader scales, monthly, annual, even a decade, so to get a sense of infiltration at that longer time scale. That being said, I've been really excited about this project. I think it helps improve my understanding of how the climate and the land use changes are affecting infiltration and affecting our water budget and our water cycle across this region that I'm responsible for planning in. And over time, it's been a very useful tool for input into our regional groundwater flow modeling. And for all of the data, this is a very simple approach. It's not an incredibly time-consuming approach, which makes it a very good tool for being able to provide this type of data without you know, a 5-10 year study, and so this was a very useful tool for us. And that's the end. Thank you.
I think we have time for some questions. You're needlessly worried about going over. We have 3 minutes now for some questions. So we'll try and pass these microphones along if I can figure out how to, or maybe the on switch is the way to go.
Thank you.
I'll ask the first question, though, since I have the power. No. I noticed there were some blocky features,
yes.
You know, some borderline faults or something going on there, and I'm assuming that has to do with land use estimates or something, or there was some, looked like some
yeah.
rather,
you we'll know. Try to find talking. A good map.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. You're talking about, well, I can't, let's see, I never use this, but right here?
Yeah, for instance.
Right here? Mm-hmm. The land use does play in, and you do see land use kind of affecting some of that, but the interpolation method for based on some of the climate data also led to some of those effects. And so just the grid cell spacing for the available climate data and then the interpolation process is... We've done some work looking into that. So, and that is something to think about, too, as you're putting together these data from different sources and, you know, having to interpolate between discrete data points, you're going to see some effects like this. And I think this is kind of odd of me to say this, but I kind of like that the results do that because it is a good visual reminder of the uncertainty and that you kind of remember where this data is coming from. But... Yeah, that is a relic of the interpolation process, and it's driven not just by land use, but also more by climate data.
Next question over here, Kelly.
So you've differentiated between infiltration and recharge, but still, what you've probably had some thoughts now about how, what kind of hard information do we actually need to calibrate and verify recharge, to really lock that down?
I've had a lot of thoughts about that, and I have to admit that I am still twisted up about exactly what data we can use to quantify this. I think there's more field data that could be collected, and I think in a more thoughtful way, because we do measure, we do look at infiltration, and I think that the growing interest, particularly in stormwater infiltration and stormwater management, is leading us to do more of that. But it's very short-term, very specific, and it's not. We don't have a data set. We don't have it compiled in one place. And so I think part of it is a data management issue. Part of it is a sort of we're thinking about it as a one-time site-specific problem, and not how can we use this to assess the broader watershed. And I also think that there's some opportunities for some data collection, but there's a lot of some instrumentation. I mean, this is really difficult to get at, and so I think that there's some monitoring networks that would be really beneficial, but we don't have them now, and the investment in instrumenting different parts of the metropolitan area to collect some of this is a challenge. That's a total cop-out answer, I know, but... I don't have a really good answer, and I'm thinking a lot of these things, but whenever I brought up sort of, you know, what could we be doing to collect more information, not unlike a lot of the sort of statewide data portal kind of stuff, when you're thinking about how do we combine a lot of data, there's a lot of pushback against wanting to invest in that, and so that's kind of the struggle. So we keep trying to find creative ways around it, but I think this is coming to a head. I think that as we are doing more of this stormwater management and trying to understand infiltration and recharge, it is kind of being raised as an issue more and more. Maybe that we are shifting. And I also think that maybe some of the remote sensing and some of those tools could be brought into bear a little bit more. But all of you creative thinkers, you 27 students who are here, those of you who have access to good databases and into shaping some of the research direction, I put the charge to you. Give me calibration data.
got time for maybe two more, one here and one in the back, and then otherwise these folks will be around today.
Thank you. So part of my question is a follow-up to your discussion of stormwater management.
Excuse me, for some reason, raise your hand.
Right here.
Oh,
I'm here.
Sorry,
sorry.
I saw one of the microphones back there. I apologize. Too distracted.
Okay. So part of my question is a follow-up on stormwater management. Can you talk briefly about your estimates as to the magnitude of change in the infiltration sizing on three management practices? One is the movement toward decentralized infiltration features for stormwater management, the reduction in infiltration because of the increase in agricultural drain tiling, and the change in infiltration due to urban piping systems, be it additional water from leakage and drinking system or removal of water from the system because of leakage into piping systems and through the bedding systems as well. Thanks.
Wow. I hope you all heard that, because I don't know if I can repeat it all. But so the magnitude of change in infiltration due to changes in stormwater management practices, agricultural drainage impacts, and changes in sort of infiltration in and out of piping systems in urban areas. I don't have magnitude numbers for those. I will say I do think that the impact of infiltration practices in terms of urban stormwater management is growing. I have talked to, I did sort of an informal survey and reached out to some watershed districts and said, you know, how many infiltration practices do you have? And do you have some estimates about, you know, how much water you're infiltrating? And so, for example, the city of Minneapolis, on record, part of what they are doing has 600 stormwater infiltration practices in the city. And I think that was, Washington County, Woodbury had several hundred. And so this is really a growing part of the urban landscape. I had just done a really quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, and, it doesn't take an unreasonable number of these practices to make, you know, a 5% change in the region's recharge. So these are kind of infiltration. So this is something that does affect our, just looking at the numbers pretty simply, I mean, it does seem to be the type of system that is impacting our water cycle and something that should be part of the planning for water supply planning. But I don't have specific numbers. But we are doing a survey at the Metropolitan Council, for example, reaching out to our watershed districts to do a survey of all those stormwater BMPs so that we have a better sense of geographically where they located and what types are where. So that's work that is actually going on right now. The ag drainage thing is something beyond what I have been working on. I've really been focusing more on the urban areas, and so hopefully we'll hear more about that today. The piping is one that I have looked into and done some research. I mean, this is something that's been looked at in other cities around the world, and the effect of leaking pipe infrastructure on aquifers and water tables. We don't have that kind of information here for the metropolitan area, although I have reached out to our, I think it's really interesting, our sewer staff, because we do all of the video logs of our sewers, part of the inspection system. And when you do find those leaks, I mean, you have substantial amounts of groundwater coming into the system, and so you know under different flow systems you're having that going in and out as well. And so obviously that's something we take very seriously, and it's part of our maintenance program. But yeah, it is very interesting that we have documented examples of, you know, how much water at a discrete point you can be coming into the system. So again, not numbers, but it's something that we're thinking about and aware of.
One more in the back there, and then we'll have to cut it off.
Yeah, I have a much simpler question for you.
Okay, that's good.
It would have been interesting to see the impact of the land use change. And I would have liked to see, you know, like one run just with one land use without any change, and the other run that you did, and see what would be the impact on this recharge. So that's, I don't know if you have done it or not.
We have not done that. One of the reasons, though, that we did make it a point this time to, instead of just using the USGS land cover, we wanted to convert this to using the Met Council's land cover categories, was to allow us to look at that. You know, it gives us that capability. We simply haven't had the time.
Okay. The second question is, do you have a sense? I said there were two questions. Oh. Do you have a sense, because you haven't taken into account the lawn watering here in this thing, you just took into account the rainfall.
Yes, that's a
Do you have a
good
sense
point.
Of the error or what we might have missed there?
No, but... Sorry.
That's
I'm,
a good
I'm looking over at Brian, my coworker Brian. He's sitting here somewhere, unless he got up and left for fear I'd pick on him. But there he is. Anyway, he is working on a lot of water conservation work at the Met Council right now. We're updating our water conservation toolbox, and that would be kind of interesting, wouldn't it, Brian? So, no, I'm not going to answer that, but that's a good idea, and we'll probably talk about that.